Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, and welcome to The Chat Returns, a mini-series of conversations about our relationships with the world's greatest animation studio, Studio Ghibli. I'm Michael Leader, and I've seen the lot of them.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and I'm still recovering from watching one of them.
So join us on our quest into the glorious world of Ghibli. Jake, welcome back to The Chat Returns. You're still recovering from one of the films, you say?
Yeah, although I think, was it our second, maybe third episode of this entire podcast? But yeah, Grave of the Fireflies, it certainly sticks with you. I may have told this story in the podcast before, but I sat down to watch it with my girlfriend, who had not seen it before, a few months ago. This was right in the midst of lockdown as well, which is already an emotionally vulnerable time. And it was a Sunday afternoon, and she just said, I fancy a bit of a weepy, you know. And I think to certain audiences, that suggests a different type of film. Maybe a film directed by Joe Wright in the mid-2000s or something. You know, that kind of Sunday afternoon ITV type weepy. Maybe not Grave of the Fireflies, which is maybe doing it a disservice to even put it in the weepy category. But yes, she watched that with me. She said that she doesn't think she's seen anything as sad.
If that was the response from you and your girlfriend after one viewing, I mean, how many times has this guy had to watch Grave of the Fireflies? This is Alex Do Dr. Wit, who's known to our listeners because he's been on the podcast a couple of times before. He is an animation critic for places like Sight and Sound, Cartoon Brew, and now he's got a book out about Grave of the Fireflies for the BFI Film Classics imprint. It's an absolutely essential read, but we'll find out as part of the interview just how many times he had to watch Grave of the Fireflies and whether he is now a husk inside.
And excitingly, Alex is not the only person out there who spent lockdown and a bit before writing a book all about Ghibli.
No, we did that too, although for our purposes, we didn't have to watch Grave of the Fireflies as many times. But you did have to rewatch all the films in the process of writing the Ghibli Attack book. It's an adaptation of the podcast into book form. We go film by film from Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind all the way to Earwig and the Witch, chapter by chapter, offering a little bit of the contextual history and production background that I like to nerd out on, followed by Jake diving into your film fan review. It was a really fun process, wasn't it, Jake?
Yeah, it was really lovely to do and to kind of put down on the page some of these thoughts and things we've been talking about for so many years now, and it feels like we can't take them back now. I'm glad that I did that key rewatch of Princess Mononoke and can confirm to the listeners that it is in fact a good film, and that is the angle that I take in my review. But, you know, any Howl's Moving Castle fans out there, you can skip that chapter.
Yes, and even though we've used the name as a pun for this mini-series, any fans of The Cat Returns may have to skip that chapter as well, I'm sure. But it was really fun from my point of view. You know, we go back to 2018, when we did many of the first episodes of the series, some of the really big films like Mononoke, Spirited Away, My Neighbor Totoro, being able to go back and hit the books, do some extra research and write out that story about how those films came to be was a real trip for me, not least because there are now new books like Alex's coming out that go deeper in terms of English language writing about Ghibli. Alex's book is the first book in English, not just on Grave of the Fireflies, but I think the first book in English solely about Isao Takahata's work as well.
So you can pick up Alex's book now. It's already out. Make sure you go and buy it. And the Ghibliotech book is going to be available from early September in the UK. You can pre-order it now. And it's out in early October if you're in the US. And in some exciting news, we noticed getting translated into a few other languages as well. We saw the Spanish front cover the other day, which was very exciting.
Particularly exciting that they took the pun at the heart of Ghibliotech and translated it into Spanish. So it's called the Ghiblioteca, which is amazing. Amazing. It'll be really fun to see what the other international editions do with that title. Although I'm sure between Ghibliotech and Ghiblioteca, that actually covers most of the Western European and Southern European languages.
We've kind of warbled along here before we got to Alex's interview quite enough. But if you want to hear even more chat from us, then make sure you head over to Apple Podcasts because we have now got a bonus subscription and new podcast available exclusively to Apple paid subscribers. So if you want to support the podcast, you can throw us some money. You'll get bonus episodes where we are kind of exploring all the things that we love doing when we're not watching the films of Studio Ghibli. There are already some episodes out there where we're talking about video games. Michael, you've just finished playing, what was it again?
Titanfall 2, a game from a few years ago that I think really didn't get the acclaim and attention that it really did because it's a fantastic game. But you can hear me talking about all that. And what did you talk about, Jake, on that episode?
I was talking about the Uncharted games, which were sold to me as, do you want to play Indiana Jones video games? Of course I do. Now I've played all of Uncharted 4. I've bought Uncharted 1, 2 and 3, and I've bought the Uncharted 4 expansion. So I'm in on Uncharted. And we also did an episode all about manga. I just recently finished the Nausicaa manga and loved going through that. And Michael and Steph also brought along some of their recent reads too. So head over to Apple Podcasts to listen to all of those conversations, as well as getting early releases of our main feed. You'll get those a few days early and you'll get them without any of the adverts as well. So lots of exciting stuff happening over there. And that must be enough chat now. I'm sure we can head over to Alex, who can tell us all about what it's like when you need to watch Grave of the Fireflies 30 times and come out the other side without your brain turning to mush.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Alex, it's such a pleasure to have you on the podcast. You've been on in the past in a live setting. I also remember you sent us a really nice little audio missive at the start of the first lockdown when you just turned 30, I think, which is really sweet. But it's so good to have you on properly. Welcome to the podcast. I suppose my first question, which is a question we often ask our guests on this, is what is your Ghibli origin story? What was your first experience and taste of Studio Ghibli and their work?
Yeah, thanks for having me on again, guys. I feel like I'm your war correspondent now, because last time it was The Wind Rises, now it's the other depressing one. So I started watching Ghibli films in the 90s when I was a child. And this was before Spirited Away and even before Princess Mononoke. And so before the whole Ghibli catalogue really had distribution over here, my family had pirated copies. Sorry, Ghibli, if you're listening to this. We got them through a cousin of mine in France, which was ahead of the curve in discovering Ghibli. They had the films before we did. And so I had some connections through my cousins who found some pirated DVDs. We had the box set, really kind of low quality image, really dodgily subtitled. I think it had been subtitled via Chinese into English, and so there was like two layers of translation, and translating the subtitles didn't make much sense. We also had a Fox dub of Totoro, which was a legitimate release. I think I watched some of them religiously, Totoro being one of them, Whisper of the Heart being another, Kiki, the ones that were kind of more appropriate for my age, 4, 5, 6 years old, not great for the Fireflies. We'll come on to that. And I loved them, and Totoro I think was like, paradoxically, even though it's kind of more realistic in many ways, less purely magical than something like Nausicaa or Mononoke, it was, to me, it was the most magical of all, because it presented a vision of what seemed to be a real world, like rural Japan, that was completely different to North London, which is what I knew. And so Totoro in particular really mesmerized me and made me want to go to Japan. And with time, it would kind of be one of the main inspirations for me going to study Japanese at university and in Japan. So yeah, I've been watching them ever since then, really. Like I've mentioned elsewhere, my father, Michael, eventually directed a film for Studio Ghibli, The Red Turtle. But at this point in the 90s, there was no talk of that whatsoever. He was just a fan of their work, like I was. And he didn't personally know anyone at Studio Ghibli. But that came later in kind of mid-2000s and so on. So they've always been with me, yeah. And I've been writing about them for as long as I've been writing about film, for the past 6 or 7 years. And that's kind of culminated in this book on Grave of the Fireflies.
Yeah, I like that you've kind of exclusively mentioned Miyazaki films or Miyazaki-related films there. But that is maybe not the main guy that we're going to be getting into today. So that was your Ghibli discovery. Where did Takahata come into this, and where you figured out that he was a guy that you wanted to be spending probably more time with than most people ever would dream of?
Yeah, so when I was a child, did I watch any? I might have watched Only Yesterday, but honestly, I can't remember. My Neighbors the Amadeus and Kaguya hadn't been made yet. His pre-Ghibli stuff was kind of unknown in the West. And Grave of the Fireflies, I don't believe I watched it when I was a child. I don't know if it's even on the box set we had. The first memory I have of watching it was when I was 14, when I went to Japan with my family. We went on a holiday and we visited a museum in Osaka, which I can't remember the name of it, but it basically focused on the plight of minorities in Japan, ethnic minorities, also the descendants of what used to be the untouchable caste in the feudal times. And this is it's quite unusual, let's say, for an institution in Japan to really be focused, devoted to that issue. So it's an interesting museum. And as it happened, they had a cinema attached, or like a mini kind of screening room, and they were playing Grave of the Fireflies. And we went in and saw it. I think we were the only people in that screening room. It was a dark room. I was not prepared for it. It clashed with, I think I understood it was a Ghibli film, but it clashed with everything I knew about Ghibli. And also with everything I'd seen in Japan, because we'd followed a pretty standard tourist trail where you see, you know, like beautiful temples and shrines and kind of crazy neon Tokyo, Shibuya downtown. But you don't really dwell on the fact that, you know, 60 years ago there was a war here and all these cities were incinerated. So it was a bit of history I had no knowledge of. And I think that would probably be true for many people here watching that film. It's we don't talk about the Japanese experience of war anywhere near as much as we talk about the Nazis or, you know, other facets of Second World War. So that was my introduction to Grave of the Fireflies, and then I became kind of obsessed with it. I remember actually watching, making people watch it on my birthday. I kind of lost, I was more into the film than I was aware of what a birthday should be. And so like, it must've been the birthday after that when I was still 14 or 15. And we just were like, a bunch of us were just like at home with no plans. And we were just like, let's watch a film. And I put that on. And then at the end of it, everyone was like, why the hell did we watch that? And all I had in response was that it's a great film. but I watched it over and over again, and then took a long break from watching it until the time where I started planning a book about it. Yeah, so I had a kind of 10-year gap where I didn't watch it at all, I think.
That's so great. That really takes me back to being a teenager and those shared viewing experiences where maybe this wasn't the impulse behind it. You say that you thought it was a great film and you weren't thinking of the experience of putting your friends through it, but similar films around that age for me, like Threads, where you'd be presenting it to people just wanting to see their reaction. You knew it was a great film, like Come and See as well, the Russian film, where it's almost an endurance test, and the fun of that, something that as an adult it's quite hard to recreate, although Grave of the Fireflies is often mentioned by, you know, many friends and colleagues and listeners who say it's one that you don't want to stumble into a film like that. You want to be told up front you're going to have a profound emotional experience watching it. So after that 10-year break, when you returned to it, why did you return to it, and what made you think this is worthy of this appraisal as a BFI film classic?
It may not have been a 10-year break, but it was a long break. And the fact that I had taken a break from it and was still often thinking about it told me that there was really something here. I had a personal reaction, a strong personal reaction to the film. It had really played on my mind ever since I'd first seen it. And I think that's the first condition you need to fill in order to write a book about something, or a BFI film classic about something. You need to like it or at least have a strong reaction to it. So I knew I had that. And then the impetus for writing a book about it actually came when I was in Japan again, much later. I spotted in a bookshop a little book about the film. And this book was part of a series that has been published kind of under the Ghibli brand. It's like critical anthology. So each book collects about, I don't know, 24 essays, interviews, personal testimonies from the staff of one Ghibli film. And so it acts as a kind of like officially sanctioned, I guess, history / critical evaluation of that film. And I saw the Grave of the Fireflies one and started flicking through it, and found that at the beginning of these books, there's always an official history written by someone at Studio Ghibli of the production of that film. And then that's followed by reflections by Toshio Suzuki, the longtime producer at Ghibli, of the production of that film, which kind of enhances the official history bit. And I was reading that and realizing that the backstory to Grave of the Fireflies was kind of bonkers, really interesting, and shed a lot of light on the people involved in it and how they worked, and was a story worth telling in itself. So I knew that that could already be an element of the book. And that got me thinking more about the film, and I rewatched it. And eventually I thought, you know, the film in and of itself has already got so much to talk about, and it's such a well-known film and yet so little discussed in detail in the English language that it warrants a more in-depth study. And then I had an agenda on top of all that, which was to get a bit more animation into the BFI Film Classic series, because I find that it's been a little neglected in the past. They only had four animated titles in the collection before my book, so now they've got five, and that's out of hundreds. So yeah, I had all these kind of different motivations, and I pitched the book based on that.
I think your book now tips the scales, so there are now more BFI film classics about animation than there are about Hitchcock films.
Really? So finally.
Progress.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair to the editors, they have kind of relaunched this series with a brief to look beyond the established canon, or to try and reimagine what a canon is, or, you know, however you want to put it, and be more diverse in all kinds of ways. And I hope more animation is one strand of that. And I know they've already commissioned more on other animated films already. So yeah, that might change.
It's so interesting that you talk about this sense of, you know, picking up the Ghibli textbook in Japan, and this whole other story behind the film is there before your eyes, and it's underreported in the West because of all these varying factors. But also what I find really illuminating about your book is that you take to task a little bit this sense that Grave of the Fireflies is this day-ruining, evening-ruining weepy that is a classic because of its emotional affect, whereas there's so much more going on in the film. But then also, it didn't just get presented to us whole cloth as this masterpiece. It's actually a very problematic production. It actually ruined Takahata's reputation at the time as well. It opens something up to me, and something that Jake and I don't speak Japanese. We can't read Japanese, so we are very aware of the limits of our access and research. However, it's been a goal for us all the way through to sort of shine a light on some of these stories that, because Ghibli is seen as this monolithic thing, often represented by Miyazaki, and we don't question or criticize or read against many of these narratives. So it's really illuminating to see that in your book. And it makes me think of, in that period between you being 14, watching this film and having the emotional experience, and then revisiting it again as somebody who'd been to Japan, learned Japanese history, culture, become a film critic, animation expert, you're bringing all this extra insight to the film. And I wonder, do you have an opinion now on this sort of world appraisal of Ghibli? Are we looking at it through just a keyhole, and we need to widen that and look at things more broadly?
I don't know about keyhole. I think Ghibli is like pretty well studied as anime goes outside Japan. Oh, I should say really in the English language, because some other territories, and notably France, have been conducting a lot of research into this whole world for a long time, and in many ways, well, are probably definitely ahead of the English academia in that respect. But so Ghibli has been relatively well studied. I mean, it's got a higher profile than any other anime studio. But anime as a whole, it's still early days. It's only probably been seen as a legitimate area of study in the academy since the 90s or even the noughties. And it's a huge field with, you know, half a century or a century of history, depending on how you define anime. Added to that is the fact that I think, yeah, Japanese is probably definitely less spoken and read than many European languages, so that adds a barrier. These Ghibli anthology books I was talking about are quite new. They haven't been around for decades. They've actually been, the latest ones only got published a few years ago. It's maybe unsurprising that they haven't got that much attention. It's actually quite a new initiative, and it's part of this phase that Ghibli has entered now, where it's kind of consolidating its legacy in a way. On the popular side, you've got the theme park opening in a couple of years or next year, and presenting all the best or most salient bits of the Ghibli brand to the public. And then on the more kind of like, yeah, scholarly side, you've got these anthologies and many other books like them, which are being written or edited or sanctioned by Toshio Suzuki and his colleagues at the studio. So yeah, I think there's still a trove of stuff to hear. I mean, what I found interesting about these histories, including one about Grave of the Fireflies, is that they're very candid and humorous and breezy, and they're full of kind of bickering. You can't really picture Pixar putting something like this out, you know, because in Hollywood, studios are much more guarded, and they control their image with a lot, well, how do I put it? Yeah, they maybe have a more of a tendency to kind of sanitize or or hide the kind of less flattering aspects of their corporate politics, whereas Suzuki talks about it quite openly, and so do the official histories, which are anonymously written, but written by someone with all the access, clearly, to Studio Ghibli's archive and so on. So it's quite entertaining to read these histories, actually. And because Studio Ghibli has always maintained a relatively small scale, considering how famous it is, it almost becomes like a soap opera. You read these histories and the same characters recur, like Miyazaki and Takahata and Suzuki are always at the heart of things, but the same animators are always kind of there on the fringes, or, you know, the same script writers, and you become familiar with the characters. I think while Ghibli's films have been thoroughly and very well analyzed by some scholars. Just a kind of like straight narrative history of the studio's origins, and 35 years of existence can still be written. I think there's a lot still to put out there.
I find there's this gulf for me between academia. Of course, yeah, as you say, animation studies is a field with lots of great work being done. But when it's something like Ghibli, where the popular audience may never rub up against the academic world, there's still so much misinformation out there, because there are very few clear English language sources for some aspects of that history. I don't know if you saw the other day, there was a viral tweet going around which had connected the dots between Topcraft, the studio that made Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind. They animated the opening sequence of the Thundercats animation series from the 80s. And somebody had just tweeted, joining the dots, saying, Takahata and Miyazaki bought Topcraft in 1985 and turned it into Studio Ghibli. And people responded saying, too long, don't read. Thundercats is a Ghibli series. And people then popping off saying, oh, I can completely see how it's the exact same thing, Thundercats and Ghibli. And it suddenly goes really way too far. And because they're basing that off maybe Wikipedia, which is an unverified line in Wikipedia, or a mistranslated line from a Japanese source, there's still so much out there that, even though you say it's very well covered in some areas, there's still so much we don't know, particularly with Takahata, I feel. When we were doing this series, Miyazaki has those two big starting points and turning point books where we can refer to his production notes and directorial memoranda. But Takahata, we have so little, it feels like.
Yeah, that was actually another reason why I pitched this book. I thought it's not just Grave of the Fireflies that hasn't been written about much. It's Takahata himself. Doing the research for the book, I basically tried to find everything that's been written about him, about Grave of the Fireflies specifically, in English. And there were many, many articles, many reviews, many kind of features that kind of sketch the historical backdrop or explain, you know, the autobiographical basis of the film. But they kind of repeat the same information over and over again. So there's kind of a few fragments of context that are out there in the domain and are being repeated, but there's very little that kind of drilled down deeper. And yeah, there's very little on his other works as well, which are a bit less well known than Grave of the Fireflies. But still, considering that he's associated closely with one of the most famous animation studios in the world, and that he's such a brilliant filmmaker, and that most of his films are accessible, I find it surprising that he hasn't been studied more. But I think that will change. I think his death a couple of years ago maybe reminded people of his existence, or prompted that kind of reevaluation that death can do. And I kind of hear rumblings that there's more research on him now underway that we'll hopefully see soon.
It's been really nice talking to different kind of filmmakers and storytellers for this podcast, and the fact that we've had two guests from like kind of Oscar nominated films come and say that they're like underrated Ghibli highlight is My Neighbors the Yamadas. It's just very lovely.
Did Tom Moore say that?
So that was Will Collins, the writer of Wolfwalkers, and Dom Ishii, who's directing Turning Red for Pixar. But going into this project, Alex, now that, like, once you knew that the book was happening and you had to chronicle this, the story of this film, how did your viewing of it change from the first time that you sat down to focus on it, where I imagine you kind of pen in hand, diligently like pausing it every minute, like the true scholar that you are, to the 30th time where it's like Sunday morning hungover thinking, oh, I've got to do it again, just in case. What is that trajectory for you?
Yeah, I did actually watch it hungover once, and that's an experience I would wish on no one. I think the first thing I'd say is I was worried at the outset that the film would lose its force through the rewatchings, and that eventually I would watch it completely dispassionately, and that would be a shame, a casualty of the whole book writing process. But actually, to my surprise, that didn't happen. I was still crying by the end, by the 30th watch or whatever it was. By that point, there were just certain things, like a little kind of cue on the soundtrack, that would just kind of like Pavlovian prompt some tears. And it was especially around the scene where Setsuko you have a kind of reel of her happiest moments that's played after she's died. So that's the first thing to say. How did my view of it change? I guess I knew going into it that it was an uncommonly powerful film, but I didn't really know why, really. I hadn't really tried to figure out what it was about it. And through the process of researching the book, I basically realized how brilliantly the characters are sketched. I don't mean literally visually sketched, well, that too, but I mean how brilliantly they're depicted as people with the nuance and all the dimensions to it. And I'm talking especially about Seta here, because Setsuko, being a little child, has less complexity to her, inevitably. She has less morality, she's less compromised. Seta is a more tragic figure. So I guess I got to know Seta more. And I also realized how perfectly the film is structured. Unlike some later Ghibli films in particular, it's very short, very concise, doesn't have a shot out of place. I think Totoro is the same. This is peak disciplined Takahata and disciplined Miyazaki. They're still working in the wake of their TV series days throughout the 70s. They've been making series on crazy deadlines. And I think the demands of that experience had taught them to tell stories incredibly concisely and very kind of rigorously. Whereas later in Studio Ghibli's life, when they had bigger budgets and to some extent were able to transcend budgetary and deadline constraints that filmmakers normally have to contend with, the films maybe became a little bit laxer as a result, or at least the narrative structure. Grave of the Fireflies is just perfectly formed, and I really don't see what scene or shot could be omitted from it. So yeah, it was an understanding of those two things, the sheer craft of the storytelling, which is Takahata's main thing. After all, he's a storyteller, he's not an animator, he's not a graphic artist, and the beauty of the characterization of Seta.
It's interesting you mentioned the kind of power of the storytelling, because my dad watched this film and he couldn't figure out how to turn subtitles on, and he does not speak Japanese. And he kind of came out of it with the same reaction that you'd expect anyone to have to watching Grave of the Fireflies for the first time. He said that it didn't matter. And we mentioned Steven Spielberg a lot on this podcast, and I've mentioned him before, as a master of kind of blocking and momentum, and that you can watch Raiders with the sound off, as Steven Soderbergh proved, and put The Social Network over the soundtrack instead, and you still totally know what's going on. And I think him watching that in Japanese and still coming out of it with profoundly moved by it shows his skill as a director.
Yeah, I mean, there's very little, well, there's not much dialogue in the film, and the dialogue that there is quite concise. This is a war film with some, serious and sophisticated things to say about war and about how we behave in it. But there's no speech in it, really. You'd expect a film like that, especially one that's meant for children as well as adults, would have a character at one point stand and kind of reel off what they've learned from the experience, or, that it would be kind of somehow crystallized in a climactic scene like that. That doesn't happen in the film. It's just people talking and saying quite banal things to each other all the way through. So maybe that's a reason why your dad could follow it even without the sound.
Well, it's also in just it's just minor gestures. That's how he brings the character out of it, and that's where the emotion comes from, not from some hugely imaginative, crazy, fantastical thing. It's just the food and the lack thereof, and just the sight of a child and that rock tumbling around in her mouth, and that's it, and that's going to break your heart, whatever language you speak.
Alex, this suggests another question that we wrestle with on this podcast, and that's language in general. And I love your particular route through this, watching the films, as you say, with French subtitles that may have come through multiple intermediate languages, then learning Japanese and now translating Japanese back into English. What is your take on this, the whole, you need to see it in the original language, you need to understand the original language, subs always over dubs? What's your take on all this?
I kind of sit on the fence on the whole sub versus dub debate in general. I always watch with subs, if it's Japanese, with or without subs. In the case of Grave of the Fireflies, I watched it with subs because I thought it was important to see how it's been translated, for the sake of my book. In this case in particular, Grave of the Fireflies, I don't think people should watch the dub unless they really feel they have to. And the reason is that more than pretty much any other film, it depends for its power on the plausibility of the characters and therefore on the performances, the voice actors. And Takahata and his team went out of their way to cast actors who are the same age as the children they play, which is unusual. Conventionally, he would have found adults who would then pretend to be children, which is what you hear in many animated productions, including Ghibli productions and other Ghibli productions. The result of that is Setsuko in particular, who's a four-year-old girl, and it's not easy to sound 4 years old if you're an adult. She is so vivid in the Japanese original. She's just so real. So is Seita. In the English dubs, they didn't preserve that. They cast adults. In fact, there are two dubs of Grave of the Fireflies. In one of them, the actor who voices Setsuko, she was in her 60s at the time. And, you know, you can hear it. I've actually never watched either of those dubs all the way through because I find it so painful. It really just completely undercuts the force of the film, I think. So I think on this one, I'll get on my high horse and say sub over dub always. In general, I mean, it's up to what people prefer and what they think is right for them. The subtitling and the dubbing for Ghibli films is generally quite good, like accurate and well-performed as well. The Grave of the Fireflies, exceptionally, was never distributed by Disney for Arcane rights reasons, and so Disney never recorded a dub for it. And I think that means that the dubs that there are for Grave of the Fireflies, that maybe the production values, quality control is slightly lower as well. And there are no like Hollywood voices. That's another thing that Disney always did, but Grave of the Fireflies doesn't have.
Yeah, I think of other Ghibli films with characters of a similar age, and you look at the Disney dub of Totoro, where it's the Fanning sisters, Dakota and Elle, who were similar age to the characters, but they are Hollywood voices. Hollywood has a tradition of child actors that has an association with us through other Disney animations, actual Disney animations rather than dubs. But in this case, I love the little trivia tidbit you have in the book where the voice actor for Setsuko in the original was potentially the youngest anime voice actor of all time to that point in Japan.
Yeah, but she was billed as that. Yeah, I wasn't able to verify that myself, but I mean, it's probable. Yeah, no one else really had done that. Yeah, it also meant that they had to record her before the animation. So they kind of reversed the process. In the anime industry, often you would have the animation more or less complete, and then the voice artists would come into the studio and dub in sync with what they see. But a girl who's five, she was five, the actress who played this girl, can't do that. And on top of that, they were worried that her voice would change in the interim if they waited for the animation to be done first. They thought she was just right as she was then, so they got her to record bulk of her lines ahead of production. And then that created an extra advantage, which is that the animators were able to kind of basically animate in line with her performance. They could draw inspiration from her little idiosyncrasies when giving Setsuko visual life. Yeah, and that's why it's just like, she's so vivid. Even though she's less complex than Seita and in many ways less interesting and not really the focus of the film, not really the moral heart of the film, she's just so alive and so real that her death is devastating. And that's why the film works so well.
And in all your kind of research in terms of the craft of this film, that's another area that Michael and I, although we can maybe talk and write about films, we're not artists ourselves going out with the ability to draw or animate. Was there any learnings that you got from like how the actual film was made that kind of shaped your interest in it?
Well, for a long time, I had this idea that Takahata couldn't draw at all. That's what he often said about himself, kind of more out of modesty than anything. And that's the received idea in discussion of Takahata. And then kind of with time, a bit before I started on this project, I kind of heard that he did sometimes draw, but I didn't really know what that meant. And then when I got down to the research for this book, I actually saw what that meant, which is that he drew kind of thumbnail storyboards. he wasn't a brilliant draftsman. Like, he couldn't draw full-on layouts, or, you know, he couldn't animate, but he had a very keen sense of composition and blocking, and that was expressed in his little thumbnail mini storyboards, which were just kind of like dashed off very roughly on the script that he'd written, as far as I could see, and maybe also elsewhere. And some of these were shown in an exhibition of his work in Tokyo that was posthumous. It happened in Japan a couple of years ago, and if you get the catalogue to that exhibition, you'll see all this material that Takahata has drawn. So I learned that he did that, and that kind of slightly complicated my understanding of him as a filmmaker. I realized that he had more visual input than I'd initially thought. He then passed those sketches, you know, those thumbnails, onto trained storyboard artists who turned them into fully fledged storyboards and so on. So there was that. And then the other thing that really surprised me was that the film was unfinished when it came out in cinemas, which I did not know until I started reading these histories. And the fact is that they just ran out of time. The film was produced incredibly quickly by Modern Ghibli standards, or by Hollywood standards, or, you know, it was turned around from initial conception to release. It was just over a year and a half. And the production itself, by which I mean the animation, took like 9 months, I think, or 10 months. I can't remember exactly, less than a year. That's fast. Like I said, Miyazaki and Takahata and all their colleagues were trained in the TV series world, which was just, in Japan especially, just like unremittingly pressurized. And so they were used to working fast. But in this case of Grave of the Fireflies, it just didn't quite work out, and they just didn't manage to finish production before release. So the film came out in Japanese cinemas with a few uncolored scenes, just black and white. and then they carried on working on it after release and eventually put out a print with a finished version. But Toshio Suzuki, in his recollection, says that a lot of people in the audience apparently just thought that the black and white unfinished scenes were a stylistic choice.
It's like the reverse Schindler's List.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But it's just quite a random scene. It's the one where Sato's being beaten for having tried to steal some vegetables. That one was black and white, and why that should be black and white and not the others, I don't know. Maybe because it's at nighttime. But yeah, the panic that kind of seized the team as they neared the finish line but realized that the finish line was a bit too close is kind of palpable in all these reports. And also I got magazine reports from the great Japanese anime magazine Animage from the time, from 86, 87, 88, when the production was in full swing. And the reporters are kind of verifying this, like reporters are visiting the studio and reporting back that the Totoro side seems fine and happy and ticking along, and the Fireflies team seems pretty down. There's like a photo of a notice that's been pinned up on the door, I think on the entrance to the Grave of the Firefly studio, with some kind of euphemistic sentence saying something like, "We very much appreciate our colleagues' acceptance of the need to work through the new year period without taking any holidays. Let's all keep trying our best till the end," or something like that. And you have this real sense of it, like, all going pear-shaped. But yeah, anyway, that's all forgotten in time now, isn't it? Because we've got the finished version and no one really thinks about this panic. But I thought it was interesting to bring up because it kind of presages what would happen later in Ghibli's life when Takahata would be indulged with more time and more money and would end up taking years and years to finish a film.
And how has spending this much time with Fireflies kind of reshaped your thoughts on the breadth of Takahata's work?
Like I said, it made me appreciate the sheer craft of his storytelling. It also kind of made me, because I rewatched all his other films as part of my research, and I started to see more clearly a common thread that runs through them, which is this kind of reflection on the idea of community and what it means to be part of a group, that ultimately is in every single one of his films, and what that community is, how that's expressed, varies from film to film. On the smallest scale, you've got My Neighbours the Yamadas, where they're part of, it's a close-knit family, a dysfunctional family, but a close-knit one, and they all draw meaning from their place within that family and their relations with each other. And on the biggest scale, you've got The Tale of the Princess Kaguya, which is a kind of fable on the meaning of being on Earth surrounded by people. Kaguya, the princess, comes from, you know, outer space, the moon, and returns to it at the end. But in the interim, she has this kind of condensed experience of human society. And when she comes to leave it at the end, she finds it very painful. And she kind of, she realizes what the meaning she's derived from being surrounded by these people for her whole short life. And Grave of the Fireflies is about that too. But there is a kind of mirror image. The characters actually abandon society. They turn their backs on it. And you could say with good reason, it depends on how you see the kind of shifting complex morality of the characters in the film, but it goes badly for them. They leave the safety net of the society. They aspire to a kind of freedom, a kind of self-sufficient life as two children, and it doesn't work out. So I think, watching it in the context of all his films, watching them all in a row like that, and his series as well, made me appreciate that kind of auteur streak that runs through his filmmaking. I think we can call him an auteur. I don't hesitate to use that word. I think in his case, that's appropriate. And I came to realise that.
You know, we love a ranking on this podcast. So you've just revisited all of his Ghibli features as part of making the book. Would you dare rank them?
I would, in my own head, privately. Do I dare say it? I think Grave of the Fireflies is, for me, his best film, full stop, because it's so tightly constructed. Yeah, I think it's that. It occurred to me while I was watching the film that we never learn the names of any of the characters except Seita and Setsuko. And that's kind of indicative of how closely focused the story is around them. Really just kind of like there's no subplots, there's no extraneous material. That's my favourite. And then Kaguya and My Neighbours the Yamadas are probably the next two. Joint, can I do that? I love the visual style in both of them, which kind of starts out in Yamadas and then is refined in Kaguya. I find them like kind of a piece with each other. Like I was saying earlier, the way they reflect on what it means to be surrounded by people that you love without necessarily always liking or being comfortable with. But Yamadas is a comic take on it, and Kaguya is a tragic take on it. Only Yesterday is sublime as well. That probably comes next, and I love the music in it. And then Pompoko comes last. Pompoko is one I've never really been moved by, although I find it really interesting. Pompoko has a structure all of its own, which is kind of cyclical, like with the seasons, right? The same things repeat themselves over and over in the film. And I find that interesting and unusual as a structure for a story, but I also find it a bit wearying after a while, and it's quite a long film. So it kind of throws in relief, I think, for me, the qualities of Fireflies as being much tighter and simpler and shorter. So that's the ranking. Are you okay with that? How does it match up with the leaderboard?
Jake, you and I slightly disagree in terms of the ordering of Takahata films. I think you're more of an Only Yesterday fan than I am. That broadly lines up with how we ranked them way back when.
Yeah, I think there's some maybe fluctuations in the middle, but the bookends are about right between us all.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned the leaderboard and Jacob's Ladder there, because we got to the end of the Ghibli catalogue. When we started this podcast back in 2018, we thought 20 odd films, God, we'll never get to the end of those. And then we did. And since then, you know, we've done these mini-series, Satoshi Kon, we've done Cartoon Saloon, and now we ask, whenever we have guests on the show, we ask them, where could we go next? And Alex, you're an animation expert, so you more than anyone should be able to point us into in a direction that we could go in. Who could we cover next?
Yeah, I mean, because for a while you were basically within the anime world, but then with Cartoon Saloon, you kind of branched out beyond that, so that opens up a whole new world of non-Japanese stuff. This is maybe quite niche, but I would like to see a mini-series on the influences on Miyazaki and Takahata, those kind of that canon of totemic films of world animation that they always go back to in their discussions about their craft and so on. The films of Yuri Lowenstein, there's The Man Who Planted Trees by Frederick Beck, there's The Snow Queen by Leonard Safanov. There's a few others. The Shepherdess and the Chimney Sweep, the King and the Mockingbird, that film by Paul Grimaud. There's not many of them. There's just like a half dozen films that the two of them always talk about and come back to. I would love to hear a miniseries on that, but that is niche. But on the flip side, because most of those are short films, they're quite accessible. So like listeners don't need to go further than Google in order to find them or YouTube. Yeah, so I would like to hear a miniseries on that. Also, in the Japanese context, I like Masaaki Yuasa, but he's quite off-brand, I guess. His filmmaking is very different from Ghibli, so maybe a bit too far.
He's been mentioned a few times, and in terms of Yuasa, there are a couple of his films where he moves towards a Miyazaki-type style, I think.
Lou Over the Wall is like almost like a parody of Ponyo.
It is, yeah. And I've definitely posted this on Twitter before, but there's a freeze frame where it looks like it's characters from Ponyo in the sort of tsunami sequence, which must be a nod. But that's a really good suggestion for the Ghibli influences. I'll take any opportunity to show off my hipster dad credentials. I've been showing Ivo, my two-year-old, Hedgehog in the Fog, quite a lot. You know, of course, he can't read the subtitles, but that's another perfect sort of short film where you can just watch it as visuals, and it's just so beautiful and beguiling as a film. And as a former Russian language student, I love the fact that he thinks that the hedgehog's name is Yozhik, which is hedgehog in Russian. So he now knows Russian as a two-year-old. Well on my way to being that awful dad.
Yeah, that's one way of doing it. I hadn't thought of that. It's also, there's a Bjork video that copies Hedgehog in the Fog. I can't remember which one it is. I think it might be Human Behavior, maybe. There's one that definitely is indebted to Nordstein. His films are very influential across the board. It's not just Miyazaki and Takahata. So there's a lot to talk about there. So yeah, that's my humble request.
That's a strong but niche request. We'll add that to the board. Alex, thank you so much for talking with us today. Congratulations on the book. I wish you nothing but the best with it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to Alex for joining us to talk about Grey the Fireflies and the process behind writing his book. Always a pleasure to hear from him. Listeners, if you like the sound of his voice, you can hear it on previous episodes. He was one of our guests for the British Museum live episodes talking about The Wind Rises, as well as he sent in a wonderful little audio postcard during our first lockdown talking about turning 30 in isolation. So go back and listen to those for more Alex, but definitely buy his book as well. It's such a great addition to any Ghibli shelf.
And if you want to keep up with everything that Alex is doing, he's on Twitter at DoodyDoc. And we're over there as well. Michael, you're there at Michael J. Leader.
And Jake, you're on there at Jake H. Cunningham. And Ghibli Tech in general is at Ghibli Tech. And you can email us at ghibli@little.studios.com.
Ghibliotech is a Little Dot Studios production. Our artwork is by Sophie Mo, our music is by Anthony Ying, and James Payne is our editor. The show is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, Harold McShill, and Steph Watts.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.